All right. So I've been watching some of the talks from this conference online with great interest, and there have been some discussions on symmetric instability already, and there's been some misinformation being spread about symmetric instability. In particular, there were some comments that said that there's no observational evidence for symmetric instability in the ocean. So the gauntlet was thrown, I've picked it up, and today I'm going to talk to you about some, I'm going to illustrate some really, I think, compelling observational evidence of symmetric instability in the ocean. So the objective is to set the record straight, but in addition to just describe to you all what is the physics of symmetric instability and why do we care. So symmetric instability, it's a sub-mesoscale instability that it forms in baroclinic currents, and it derives its kinetic energy from the thermal wind shear. This is a familiar thermal wind equation. B is the buoyancy. It's characterized by coherent structures, these slantwise overturning cells that have flow along isopycnals. This is a numerical simulation that I ran several years ago, illustrating symmetric instability. Isopycnals are in gray, so we have a front, and the velocity vectors are these vectors. The tails of the vectors are the x's. So we have these slantwise overturning motions. What's shown in color is the velocity into and out of the page, and you can see that the overturning circulations advect momentum, they're mixing momentum, they're driving a momentum flux, that's how they get their energy. And the secondary circulations associated with this SI drive frontogenesis, they create these frontlets. So the width of these overturning cells and frontlets scales like the depth of the boundary layer divided by the slope of isopycnals. The aspect ratio of these cells is given by the slope of isopycnals. So these overturning circulations are unstable to secondary instabilities. This is a figure from John Taylor and Roth's work showing how these overturning instabilities go unstable to KH instability. And collectively, the coherent structures plus this small-scale turbulence is referred to as SI turbulence. And it's unique in that it forms in a stratified boundary layer, and it derives its energy from the ocean circulation as opposed to the winds, the buoyancy fluxes, or the surface waves, and therefore it represents a sink of kinetic energy for the ocean circulation. That's one of the reasons why we care about it. Okay, so the outline of this talk, well, as I said, the objective is to really show the observational evidence for SI in the ocean. And I'm going to show three examples, one from persistent upper ocean fronts in western boundary currents like the Kuroshio and the Gulf Stream, ephemeral fronts in the East North Atlantic that were made as part of the Osmosis Project, and then some more recent observations in the bottom boundary layer associated with deep waters in the Southern Ocean. I'll finalize this talk with some thoughts on parametrizing SI turbulence. But first, I'd like to start out with some of the theory and numerical simulations, telling you about what is the instability criterion, its energetics, and what is the forcing that's conducive for driving SI. So SI, it's an overturning instability that develops when the Ertel potential vorticity takes the opposite sign of F. Ertel PV is the dot product of the absolute vorticity with the buoyancy gradient, and there are several ways you can make the PV take the opposite sign of F. The simplest way, when you have no background flow, is when you have unstable stratification. This is gravitational instability. It derives its kinetic energy from buoyancy fluxes. If you have no horizontal buoyancy gradient, yet you have vorticity, if the absolute vorticity takes the opposite sign of F, you have centrifugal instability. It derives its energy from the lateral shear production, where S is a cross front, the cross stream direction. Now, symmetric instability forms at ocean fronts or just baroclinic currents in general, where you have a strong horizontal buoyancy gradients. In particular, when the Richardson number based on the thermal wind shear is below a certain value that depends on the vorticity. And so, for example, if there's a flow with no vorticity, the critical Richardson number is 1. So it's higher than the instability criteria for KH. And it derives its kinetic energy from geostrophic shear production. It's getting its energy from the thermal wind shear. So the way that you distinguish these various instabilities is through, really through their energetics and what term in the PV is making the PV take the opposite sign of F. So like all hydrodynamic instabilities, it drives the system to a state of marginal stability. And for these overturning instabilities, it's when Q is equal to zero. And for in a bare clinic current, where it's SI unstable, the state of marginal stability corresponds to a stratified boundary layer with a stratification that goes like the square of the horizontal buoyancy gradient. So here's an example of a numerical simulation of a boundary layer that's SI unstable, and this is the potential vorticity field. This is a lateral average of that PV field, the black curve, and you can see that it homogenizes that layer, driving it to a state of Q equals zero. Okay, and this corresponds to a Richardson number that is close to one. So SI flow is unstable to SI when the PV is the opposite sign of F. If it's driving the system to a state of PV equals zero, SI is trying to extinguish itself. And so to keep SI going, you need to have some destabilizing forcing. And what do I mean by destabilizing forcing? Forcing that reduces the potential vorticity of the fluid. So the PV is governed by this equation here, where convergences and divergences of a PV flux give rise to a change in potential vorticity. The PV flux has three components, an advective component and two non-advective terms, one involving frictional forces F, the other involving diabatic processes D, everything that causes a Lagrangian rate of change of buoyancy. And if at the surface of the ocean we have a diabatic or frictional PV flux, the vertical component of which, if it's upward, it means you're extracting PV from the fluid. This is a northern hemisphere example, and you'd be reducing the potential vorticity. So a frictional PV flux, well, the diabatic PV flux is an easy one to understand. When you have some term that's causing the buoyancy to be reduced, so D is negative, when you have buoyancy loss, that will reduce the PV. You reduce the stratification and PV. The frictional term involves a horizontal buoyancy gradient and the frictional force, and this can be driven by winds, and winds in a particular direction. So if you have a front with dense water here, light water here, and you have a wind blowing in the direction of the thermal wind shear, that's what I refer to as a down front wind, that will generate a frictional PV flux that's upward that reduces the PV. And conceptually, you can think about it as that wind drives an Ekman flow, which pushes denser water over light, destabilizing the water column, reducing the PV. And the strength of that destabilization goes like this quantity we refer to as the Ekman buoyancy flux, the dot product of the Ekman transport with the surface buoyancy gradient. And as you'll see, that this quantity is also scales the energetics of this turbulence. Another way that you can generate a frictional flow that reduces the potential vorticity in the ocean is at the bottom of the ocean along a slope boundary. So if you have a slope boundary and you have a current that is moving in the direction of Kelvin wave propagation, this is the northern hemisphere example, so the coast is on the right, that will generate a frictional force that's trying to slow that current, so that's out of the page. Calculate del B cross F, that results in a frictional PV flux that's out of the ocean that will be reducing the PV. And so conceptually, you can think about this as that frictional force will generate an Ekman flow that's downslope, it's pushing lighter water in, under dense, it's destabilizing the current, reducing the potential vorticity. Okay. So a symmetric instability that's actively being forced by destabilizing forcing, we refer to it as forced SI. And so I'm going to show two examples of large eddy simulations of forced SI. One, for the case where it's just driven by buoyancy loss at the surface, and the other, it's driven by an Ekman buoyancy flux that's upward when you had a downfront wind. And these are large eddy simulations run by John Taylor. This was his work with Roth, and this is a simulation that we both analyzed with the downfront winds. So let's start out with this simulation. So this simulation started out stably stratified, initially with positive PV everywhere, and they turned on the buoyancy loss at the surface. And what you see happens if you look at the laterally averaged PV field as a function of depth and time, you see the development of this layer with near zero potential vorticity. If we look at a profile at day 10 here, that's the black curve here, you can see that the PV is hovering around the zero line. Looking at the Richardson number, you can see that it's non-zero, so that's telling you that this boundary layer is actually stratified. At the top of the layer, there's a region where the stratification is actually negative and the PV is negative. So you can see that the boundary layer is being split up into two parts. So the fact that the PV is staying around zero in this interior of this zero PV layer puts some constraints on the PV flux in that layer. In particular, the PV equation in this layer states basically that the PV does not change with time, and that PV is given by convergence or divergence of a PV flux. So that tells you that the PV flux has to be uniform in that layer. But it has to be non-zero so that you're extracting PV from this lower layer so that you can have deepening with time. So remember this constraint when we're talking about parameterizing SI in the ocean. Okay, so as we said, that this boundary layer is split into two layers, an SI a layer with stable stratification, and another layer that's unstably stratified that has very low negative Richardson numbers. Those layers are also distinguished by the energetics of the turbulence in those layers. And in particular, this near-surface layer, which Taylor and Ferrari referred to as the convective layer, derives its TKE from adiastrophic shear production and buoyancy fluxes. And so it's like a classical mixed layer in the ocean. The layer beneath is what we termed the SI layer, and it derives its energy from the geostrophic shear production. And it's stratified with the Richardson number that's around 1. And this is illustrated in some results from the simulation that's forced by downfront winds, where the Ekman buoyancy flux was greater than 0. So what we're looking at, the blue curve is the total shear production curve. The cyan curve is the geostrophic shear production. So you can see in this surface layer that's the convective layer in this simulation, the agiostrophic shear production is dominating. And the dash purple curve is the dissipation, so that's being balanced primarily by dissipation. Beneath that layer, you can see that the shear production terms follows the geostrophic shear production. And so this is the SI layer, and that geostrophic shear production is balanced by dissipation. Okay, so John Taylor derived an equation, an implicit expression for that convective layer depth. And I re-expressed it in terms of ratios of friction velocities or turbulent velocity scales to the change in geostrophic velocity across the boundary layer. There's two turbulent velocity scales depending on whether or not you're forcing the ocean with buoyancy flux, so this is the convective scale, and then we have the friction velocity. That's proportional to the square root of wind stress. So let's look at the case, let's look at the two limits of this this solution in the case where you have no buoyancy flux, but you have a wind stress. In the limit where the friction velocity is much greater than the change in geostrophic flow across the layer, little h, the convective layer depth, basically fills the entire boundary layer depth. That makes sense. There's no SI layer. The turbulence gets its energy from the winds. It's a classical mixed layer. In the other limit, where the friction velocity over the change in geostrophic velocity is much less than 1, the convective layer is tiny relative to the boundary layer depth, and the turbulence in that boundary layer is getting its energy from the geostrophic flow via SI. So the key point being is that we have a new criterion for forced SI. You can have a layer that has negative PV, yet not necessarily be dominated by SI turbulence. That domination only occurs when the friction velocity to delta UG is much less than 1. And those of you who study Langmuir turbulence, you can see the analogs to the turbulent Langmuir number here. So why do we care about SI? Well, it's because it extracts kinetic energy from the geostrophic flow, and so we'd like to parameterize it. John Taylor came up with this parameterization for the geostrophic shear production in a SI boundary layer. And it's this piecewise function that depends on the sum of the Ekman buoyancy flux plus the surface buoyancy flux. And it's decays linearly with depth through the boundary layer. And the geostrophic shear production term from the LES is shown in the green curve. The dashed green curve is the parameterization, so you can see that it does a good job. So we have a prediction for how much geostrophic shear production there should be in a boundary layer. We know that the geostrophic shear production nominally should balance the dissipation. So if you go out and make observations of dissipation in the boundary layer in the ocean, we can quantitatively test whether or not SI is active in that boundary layer. So just to summarize, what are the identifying characteristics of SI turbulence in the ocean if we want to actually go observe it? Well, there's 6 criterion. First of all, the PV has to be the opposite sign of F or near zero in a flow with thermal wind shear. It has to be stably stratified. The absolute vorticity has to be the same sign as F. And you need some forcing that actually reduces the PV. And that convective layer depth has to be shallower than the boundary layer depth. And finally, the strength of the turbulence in that boundary layer should exceed what you'd expect just from wind forcing or buoyancy loss or alone. So I'm going to present several observations that meet all of these categories or some of them, most of them. And the first set of observations comes from strong fronts in western boundary currents. Here I'm showing you several examples of cross sections of the potential vorticity and density field in these frontal flows. Isopycnals are shown in the contours. The potential vorticity is shown in color. And so you can see in all of these examples, subpolar front of the Japan East Sea, the Kuroshio, the Gulf Stream in two field campaigns, you see stably stratified fluid and negative potential vorticity. So I'm going to focus on 2 examples here in detail, the ASOP data set from the Kuroshio and the LATMIX data set from the Gulf Stream. So the Kuroshio. Eric DeSaro and Craig Lee went out there. They deployed one of Eric DeSaro's mixed layer floats. It's a very clever design. It's neutrally buoyant, has this little skirt, and it can track the three-dimensional velocity in the boundary layer almost exactly, so you can get both the turbulent properties in the boundary layer, and you can use it as a Lagrangian platform from which to follow with a ship. And this is the ship track in the particular experiment. And they were towing this tri-axis with the ship, which measures temperature and salinity. You can get the density in very high resolution. And there's also a shipboard ADCP, so you can get the velocity to calculate the potential vorticity. Here's an example of what they saw. This is a waterfall plot. This is the ship track crossing the front. What's shown in color is the density field, light water here, dense water here. The frontal interface is the white colors. The float and its density is shown here, so you can see the float was deployed smack dab in the center of the front. And they observed a front that had negative potential vorticity, very strong thermal wind shear, and a delta UG that exceeded U star by 50 times. So they put in the float. The float is cycling up and down in that boundary layer. It's measuring the turbulent velocity scale. And Eric DeSaro has thrown this float into the world's oceans, into hurricanes, into storms. And you see that the turbulent velocity scale has this monotonic relation with the wind speed. This makes sense. Primarily, that boundary layer turbulence is getting its energy from the winds, except at this sharpest front in the Kuroshio. There is an excess turbulence given the strength of the wind, suggesting that The turbulence is getting its energy from the currents. And it's SI unstable. Can't it suggests that it should be extracting that kinetic energy from the boundary from the current following the physics of SI. So we can test that. Eric Dessauer's floats can be used to estimate the depth integrated dissipation by looking at frequency spectrum of the acceleration of the float. And this is a time series of that dissipation. So that's the red circles here. And so at the sharpest front, you saw a peak in dissipation. And if you compare that to scalings for the dissipation based on the wind, U star cubed, you can see that the winds can't explain it. As we've seen before, buoyancy fluxes were negligible. But if we use our parameterization for SI, which depends on this Ekman buoyancy flux, there's a quantitative it agrees quantitatively with the theory. So I think this is the strongest example of the strongest evidence of SI that we have. So we also did this in the Gulf Stream in 2012, similar strategy. We had a very strong front, and we experienced strong winds. The wind vectors are shown in the green vectors here. And you can see those winds had a component in the down front direction to generate negative potential vorticity. And I'd like to point out that we also deployed dye in the front, followed it with the float, and we can see the dispersal of the dye in this flow field. And I'll get back to that at the end of the talk, hopefully. So here are cross sections of the potential vorticity as a function of time, isopycnals in black. So you can see there's negative PV, stable stratification. The vorticity was positive. We're on the north wall of the Gulf Stream. It's SI unstable. We can measure estimate the dissipation. That's the black circles here as a function of time. And the prediction for what the dissipation should be given the wind and buoyancy field is this magenta solid line. And you can see that there's an excess dissipation given the winds. And when we see that excess dissipation, it's when the potential vorticity in the boundary layer is negative. Okay, so let's see. So I've talked about the dissipation, which is associated with small-scale turbulence. Is there any evidence for coherent structures? So there's this recent data set that was collected as part of CASPERS using airborne SST imagery that suggests that they saw some evidence of the coherent structures associated with SI. Here's some the swaths that were crossing the Gulf Stream front. This is SST, very high resolution. This is 4,000 meters. And so you can see the main SST front, but you can also see these frontlets and these temperature steps that are on the cold side of the front. And you can see that the fronts, these temperature steps are aligned with the main front. They weren't aligned with the waves, so it's suggesting that it's not SI turbulence. And the width of these steps is around 100 meters. They also had hydrographic measurements to measure the lateral density gradients and the vertical density gradients, and a profile at the location where these steps were observed shows that the thermal wind shear in the boundary layer exceeds the stratification, which is shown in N, so the blue curve, in a boundary layer that's 5 meters thick. So this is a very thin layer, but it has strong thermal wind shear and it's unstable to SI. So if we go back to the theory for the SI cells, it predicts that the width of the front, width of these frontlets should go like the boundary layer depth divided by the isopycnal slope. If you take the isopycnal slope in this region, that predicts a 200 meter wide SI cells. So that's consistent with the SST images. Okay, so we've seen SI also in ephemeral fronts. These are observations from the Osmosis Project. Andy Thompson's paper from 2016. They, using gliders, they've made cross-section of the front. The fronts here are 10 to 100 times weaker than those in Western boundary currents, but nonetheless, you see regions with negative PV, stable stratification. Now, finally, I'd like to talk about some observations in the bottom of the ocean and the bottom of the world in the Southern Ocean. And these come from the DynNOPO field campaign. that was objective was to measure Antarctic bottom water flow and its transformation through the Orkney Passage. The lead PI was Alberto Naveira Garabato, and I'd like to thank him for letting me share these slides with you. And I'd also like to acknowledge all the scientists and crew who went out and made these measurements in what must have been quite challenging conditions. So Antarctic bottom water leaves the Weddell Sea, enters the Southern Ocean, and makes a sharp left turn in the Orkney Islands. And so having the coast to the left of you in the Southern Hemisphere means that you're going in the direction of Kelvin wave propagation. And so it's in the sense to destabilize the flow in the bottom boundary layer. So here's some cross-sections of density in contours and the along slope velocity in color. And so you can see the flow is into the page here. This is the cross-slope velocity. So positive means downslope flow. And so that's exactly what we expect, an Ekman flow that's downslope, which is steepening isopycnals. There's enhanced shear and enhanced dissipation as well in this bottom boundary layer. Alberto calculated the potential vorticity field, and we're in the Southern Hemisphere, so unstable PV corresponds to positive PV, and you can see regions of positive PV or near zero PV in that bottom boundary layer. And you can further look at the density field and classify whether or not the flow is unstable to SI, centrifugal instability, or gravitational instability using a method that I derived in 2013. And that's what Alberto did. The red regions are SI unstable regions. The purple regions are gravitationally unstable regions. Blue is a mix between the two. And the cyan are centrifugally unstable to symmetrically unstable regions. So these instabilities are active. And what they appear to be important for is for laterally mixing properties from the boundary layer into the ocean interior and in mixing this Antarctic bottom water and diluting it. So in the upper ocean, we also saw the potential importance of SI in mixing properties across the Gulf Stream front. And this was with that dye that was deployed in LatMix. And I'm going to show you a movie of the dispersal of the dye as a function of time. And just to orient yourselves, we're back up at the upper ocean. Isopycnals are in black. Salinity is in color. So this is the north side of the Gulf Stream. This is the south side of the Gulf Stream. And the dye contours are in green. If we run this movie, you can see that the dye mixes in the vertical and in the horizontal. And this is a span of about half a day. Let's run that again. So within a half a day, the dye has dispersed across the width of the front. And so if you plug in some of the numbers, and when this dispersal is happening, it's when the PV is most negative. It's when the flow is symmetrically unstable. So the dye spreads 5 kilometers in half a day. That corresponds to a lateral diffusivity of 100 meters squared per second. So SI could contribute significantly to the lateral flux of tracers across the gyre boundary. Okay, so Jacob Winograd, John Taylor, and I have been thinking about, well, how does this lateral dispersal happen? And we think it has to do with shear dispersion driven by the secondary circulations that are forced by SI turbulence. So here's the idea. So the vertical momentum fluxes associated with SI will drive a secondary circulation following a turbulent Ekman balance. And the sense of that secondary circulation is restratifying. You have this overturning circulation. And those of you who are paying attention in Jim's talk will recognize that this is very analogous to the turbulent thermal wind dynamics. And this is no coincidence. It's just that SI turbulence is now providing the turbulence in this boundary layer, and it can drive a secondary circulation. So the idea is that the combination of the shearing motion in this secondary circulation plus the enhanced turbulence in that boundary layer can give rise to shear dispersion. And we think that's what's happening. Okay. Finally, and I'm going to just comment quickly on what considerations we need to have when parametrizing forced SI in the ocean. So the goals for its parameterization, it should deepen a boundary layer while keeping the PV near zero. And this, to do that, you need a vertically uniform non-zero PV flux, as I mentioned earlier in the talk. Okay? So the question is, can a parameterization using a simple down gradient turbulent flux meet these goals? Well, let's think about the following situation. If we have a frontal zone with uniform thermal wind shears, and so it's constant, no vorticity, and the PV is zero. If we use a down gradient flux formulation to parameterize friction, this is the X component of the frictional force, and the adiabatic processes, and we define a Prandtl number, a turbulent Prandtl number, mu over kappa, you can show, if you plug in these expressions into the expression for the PV flux and using the thermal wind shear, under the conditions that the flow, the along front flow is dominated by the geostrophic velocity, and under the conditions of a zero PV layer, that PV flux scales with the stratification, the vertical gradient in that diffusivity, and the Prandtl number minus one. Therefore, if you use a down gradient formulation for the turbulent fluxes with a Prandtl number of one, the PV flux is zero. And that's, we can't have that. We need a non-zero PV flux to extract PV from the bottom of the boundary layer. So you need either parameterizations with a non-zero, not the Prandtl number not equal to one, and Scott Bachman has developed such a parameterization, or possibly using non-local transports. Okay, so just to summarize, SI turbulence is unique because it doesn't derive its energy from the winds or from the buoyancy losses. It derives its energy from the ocean circulation, and it represents a sink of kinetic energy for the circulation. So we care about it because it contributes to closing the KE budget of the ocean circulation. It also mixes tracers laterally. And finally, it sets the PV that enters the ocean interior. And in thinking about the large-scale circulation, the PV is that dynamical scalar that sets the circulation. So we want to know how it's set, and SI contributes. All right.
Okay, I'll ask a question first.
Okay.
So, when you are thinking about the traditional SI approach, you have dominance of a geostrophic shear or the other flavors of shear, which, as the Rossby number gets larger and towards the front that Jim was talking about, that part is dropping away. But the other thing that happens is fronts get windy, and then SI become very inefficient. So all of your observational cases have been in very straight, relatively low Rossby number fronts compared to the sort of super submesoscale Rossby number 5, 10 fronts we've been looking at otherwise. So how do you imagine seeing this other?
Well, I think that those high Rossby number flows where it's much greater than one, there's a transition from a lower Rossby number to a higher Rossby number. I think in those periods where you have a lower Rossby number flows, then SI is actively controlling or playing an important role in the circulation. And thinking about turbulent thermal wind dynamics where you get frontogenesis, you need something that's mixing the momentum. And SI can contribute to mixing the momentum, driving that secondary circulation, what gives rise to that strong, those high Rossby numbers. So it might not be active in those later phases, but I think it's important in those earlier phases.
And is there a signature then that you see in, like maybe little h, big H world in terms of what the secondary circulation, would you expect there to be a signature that the momentum mixing would go deeper than, say, the convectively uniform case or something like that?
Well, that's certainly the case in the classical SI layer. Yeah, that it's momentum mixing is extending through the boundary layer. I mean, that's how it's driving its energy.
Yeah.
But also that the vertical structure of that momentum flux is essential for that secondary circulation. And so understanding what sets that vertical structure in an SI layer is important for the vertical circulation of the secondary circulation.
Okay.
So I guess my question is related to just what you've said. So in the vertical flux of PV, there's also a D by DZ of kappa.
Exactly.
Which you didn't comment upon. Maybe you would like to now?
Yes, thank you. So what do we expect kappa, how should it vary in the boundary layer? At the surface, kappa is, it's not a rhetorical question. At the surface, kappa is what?
It goes to zero.
And at the base of the boundary layer?
It goes zero.
So there's a maximum in the interior. Therefore, beneath that maximum is where d kappa z is positive. Stratification is positive in an SI layer. And so if you have a Prandtl number that's greater than one, that's where you have a positive, an upward PV flux. And that's where you need it to be upward because you're chewing that PV from the thermocline. But up near the surface, you have a reversal in sign, and then you'd have a convergent PV flux that will actually give rise to an increase in PV. But so the vertical structure of kappa is important.
But so is getting to turbulent Prandtl number bigger than one.
Yes.
And what are the ways you think that?
Well, so I think it's that since SI is, so should I repeat the question?
Sure, please.
Okay, so Jim was asking, you know, it's how do you get to a Prandtl number, turbulent Prandtl number greater than one? And so that's telling you that under those conditions, mixing the momentum is stronger than mixing a buoyancy. Well, for that makes sense for coherent structures associated with SI turbulence because they are primarily along isopycnals. And so they're mixing momentum more than buoyancy.
But it's contrary to the more conventional boundary layer turbulence parameterizations.
Right.
Which by default usually go pretty close to Prandtl number one.
Exactly. So that's why we have to be careful when using KPP. We might not be doing the right thing, especially when you're trying to set the PV in the boundary layer.
There's one back there, right here. Go ahead, Jake.
Sorry, it was nice to see a distinction made between persistent and ephemeral fronts. I've never seen that mentioned before, but I'm deeply curious about it. So the picture, I think, is pretty clear for the persistent front case. Could you say more? You were pretty brief about the ephemeral front, what's known, what's not known. I mean, it's less clear that it's a continuously forced case.
Right. So.
Like what likelihood it is that SI is always present sometimes?
Well, so that's, so I skipped over, I guess, the key point there. Andy and co-authors, they also, they also calculated the ratio of the convective layer depth to the boundary layer depth. And what you notice is, and so this is, so this scatter plot here is that ratio as a function of mixed layer depth. The green dots are where the flow was unstable to SI. And so you can see that it tends to range between 0.5 and 0.8, so not very small. And so this suggests that for these ephemeral fronts, the boundary layer turbulence is probably not dominated by SI turbulence, that it's a mix of, you know, classical boundary layer turbulence and SI turbulence. But nonetheless, there is a source of kinetic energy coming from the geostrophic flows.
I'm not sure I have a great way of phrasing this question, but I'll do the blunt way, going back to the parameterization.
Yeah.
Why do you want to parameterize your PV flux as a gradient parameterization? If I may just elaborate on that. In sort of traditional boundary layer parameterizations, we try and model the fluxes in the interior through diffusive or non-local transports. But the entrainment from below is a transformation process. And while some parameterizations do try and represent that as a diffusive effect, bulk models do not, and that actually in some ways can be a more effective way of representing that process. So I just wonder if an entrainment way of thinking might work better with your PV flux, particularly from the below the mixed layer into the mixed layer.
Yeah.
If you have any thoughts on that.
We have not explored using non-local transports for this problem. And so, and that's just, you know, this is very much work in progress. And so we've just used, you know, local formulations. So I think the next step would be to consider non-local transports in parameterizing that PV flux. And
yeah, and in order to get around that, in the Bachmann paper, it's in a long isopycnal diffusion like we do in the deep ocean, so that it doesn't disrupt all the buoyancy fluxes, but it still can transport momentum. So
yeah, Peter.
Two questions, Lee.
Yeah.
Can you comment whether all your scaling works the same for a filament as it does a one-sided front? Okay, just like.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you seem, I think I interpreted it right, that KH was the main mechanism for homogenizing things at the start of the talk. I never see KH in a fully developed turbulent boundary layer. That mechanism is just too delicate to survive 3D turbulence. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, so let's start with KH. We haven't really looked at it in detail. Very qualitatively, it looks like KH, but in those simulations that John Taylor and Roth ran. But, you know, those were 2D simulations, and so perhaps we should only... Right. But the point is there are secondary instabilities that develop that that lead to, you know, enhanced geostrophic shear production and that eventually dissipates that kinetic energy that's been generated, that's been extracted from the thermal wind shear, and takes it to the small scales where you can dissipate it. Okay, so we haven't looked into the details of those secondary instabilities. Your first question about secondary circulations and whether or not the parameterization works.
To comment whether a one-sided front versus a filament.
Yes, so I was reading your paper just before, you know, last week, in carefully of looking at your simulations of a two-sided front or a filament, and was looking at the case, you know, the simpler case where you're just forcing it by cooling, right? And that sets up this nice secondary circulation, as Jim pointed out. And it also induces turbulent momentum fluxes, which are shown here. This is the V prime W prime. This is the V prime is the along front component. And so this is the term that you want to look at when calculating the GSP. And so this was non-dimensionalized, but you can dimensionalize it by W star. And so I just estimated that what the V prime W prime was. From your paper, I calculated the thermal wind shear, and from that, I calculated the geostrophic shear production term. And these are the values that I'm getting. And if you compare that to the buoyancy loss that you exerted in the surface of this simulation, it exceeds that buoyancy loss, but those numbers could just be since I've just been eyeballing it. So they're similar. So the parameterization for SI turbulence suggests that in a cooling forced simulation, that geostrophic shear production should scale with that buoyancy loss. So at least during this time, which is early in your simulations, I think SI turbulence could be active and contribute to driving that secondary circulation. But once you let that frontogenesis, you know, take off, then it's a very different story.
We always found that because it was a filament, the secondary circulation, the red stuff over there, that return current was always sufficient to prevent buoyancy being transported over the top.
Ah, okay. So you're thinking about the wind-driven case.
Yes. In this example, okay.
But I mean, you're... Right. So you're talking about this case.
If you go back... go back to the previous.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. This guy is going this way.
Right.
And so it prevents any sort of transport over the top there.
But in this simulation, you're forcing it by cooling.
Yep.
Right. So there is diabatic processes in the surface that are reducing the potential vorticity. I think in this run where you actually had winds, you had a comment about how, you know, so this is that secondary circulation, and if there was no filament there, the flow would all be to the right, right?
Nope. In the green part, there is.
If there were no filament, right? And so so the winds would be this. The winds would be down front for this front, and you would. In the conceptual picture of how you reduce the PV in the ocean, of pushing denser water over light that would generate negative PV, that's not happening because the secondary circulation associated with TTW dynamics is canceling the Ekman flow.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Yeah, but nonetheless, you see negative PV in that region. And so this is a point that I wanted to make, that view of downfront winds generating an Ekman transport, which reduces the PV, that's just a conceptual picture. That you can generate negative PV with downfront winds in the absence of Ekman flow dynamics. The winds can simply generate horizontal vorticity, which projects on that buoyancy gradient and generates negative PV. And I think that's actually what's happening in the Lapnix field campaign. Let's just look at these sections. This is sections of PV. This is when the winds were maximally down front, but those winds were ramping up quite rapidly. So there wasn't enough time for a classic Ekman layer to develop. Yet nonetheless, you see negative PV. And I think it's just the winds, they're accelerating a sheared flow that projects onto the buoyancy gradient in the correct direction to generate low PV. So the lesson to be learned, you don't need Ekman advection of denser water or light to generate negative PV. Yeah. Jim.
Just a remark. I don't know of any important way in which fronts and filaments are different.
Okay.
Do you?
Filaments are faster. Yeah, it's not important.
Well, fine. At a quantitative level, sure, there are differences.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Let's thank everybody. Time for lunch.